Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Friday, February the 17th. And today we're going to continue our series of World War II programs with our good friend Barry Jacobson, military historian, military blogger. And today we're going to talk about one of the great personalities of World War II, the man that they used to call the Desert Fox, one of the great names of World War II, one of the great nicknames, I should say, of World War II. Of course, we're talking about General Rommel, who was one of the, I think at one point, the number two person in the German chain of command. We're going to look at how he got the name, the Desert Fox. This has always been a curiosity of mine. How did he get that name? You know, it's the name of a book. It's the name of a movie. But did he get that name before, or did he get that name after the movie was made? I don't know. We're going to try to find that out from our friend Barry today. We're going to look at this man. Who was he? Maybe a few things about his life. Where did he come from? What kind of a background did he have? We're going to look at his career. How did he get into the military? What military school did he go to? What military minds did he have as he became a soldier? We're going to look at his association with Hitler. How did he become associated with the Hitler movement, the Nazi movement that came into power in the 1930s? We're going to look at all of that. We're going to look at his military record. He obviously had a very successful military record. I mean, if you look at the quality of those military generals, we talked about this with Barry a few shows ago. This was a really good group of military generals. They really, really knew what they were doing. And in many ways, as we talked to Barry a few weeks ago, when we discussed some of the military people, some of the military figures of World War II, if Hitler had listened to his military advisors, the war could have gone different. I mean, there's no question that Hitler reversed a lot of the decisions of his military. And then we're going to look at his downfall. So we're going to look at his career, his life, with our good friend Barry Jacobson. In fact, we've got Barry on the phone right now. Why don't we say hello to Barry? How are you, Barry?
I am well. I am in stormy San Diego. We're having an unusual winter rainstorm.
That's what I hear, that you're getting a little bit of a storm out there. I thought that song, "It Never Rains in Southern California." That's what I used to hear. There was that famous song back in the late 70s, wasn't it, or in the 70s, "It Never Rains in Southern California." I forgot the name of the artist.
Was Albert Hammond.
That's it, Albert Hammond, I think from Australia, I believe, who recorded that song. So, I mean, you can learn so much by listening to our show. I'm telling you, this is just unbelievable stuff that you can learn by listening to our show.
We are legends in our own mind.
That's it. This is a show full of knowledge and information, and we're going to talk today about, I was saying in my introduction, one of the great personalities of World War II, and I mean that as a military figure, of course. He was on the other side and not a good man, by certainly from our point of view, but certainly one of the great personalities. And then later in the show, we're going to take a few minutes and talk about something that happened in Los Angeles over the last couple of days, where a presidential candidate, Mexican presidential candidate, López Obrador, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, that's his name. I'm not showing off my Spanish, but that is that is his name.
If your Spanish is better than my Spanish.
That's right. That's right. Well, this guy's got such a long name in Mexico, they just call him L.O., Lo, you know, L.O., and that's just the short for his name. But he's a leftist candidate, and, well, I'll tell you what I think of him later in the show, because I was really impacted by what he did and wrote a little post, and appreciate the fact that a lot of my friends enjoyed it, as well as a lot of other people who send me some good comments. But let's talk about the Desert Fox, and I don't know if I should ask you this question now or at the end, but I all my life I've been fascinated about his name. How did he get that name, Barry?
I don't know. I'm ashamed to say this. I searched all day after you and I spoke earlier and you asked me this question, so I said I'd do some research. I've always known that Rommel was called the Desert Fox. We all know that. But you posed what turned out to be a real interesting question, which is where did he get that name? And the best I can figure out is sometime during the war, the British were calling him that. So my guess is it probably would be found, though I haven't found it, somewhere in some British memoir, perhaps the British news media came up with that, perhaps Winston Churchill came up with it, but I can't find the exact date or the exact time.
Yeah, I'm just curious. There was a movie, of course, about called Desert Fox, based on a book by the same name. I don't
right.
know the answer,
by
but
Desmond
Young. Do you know the what was his nationality?
The author was British, Desmond Young. He wrote
okay.
The Desert Fox. The Rommel author wrote his own memoirs, which were published in the 1950s, and it was called his memoir was called War Without Hate. Because his desert campaign was remarkable in that, unlike almost any other theater of World War II, there was not this hatred between the two combatants that you see everywhere else.
I'm gonna bet you a Diet Coke. That's all I ever bet. That it's the British who created that name. Because if it's a British author, very likely it came from the British. So I'm gonna stake my reputation on that conclusion. that it was a nickname that came from the British, just because the fellow who wrote the book is British and probably maybe had access to some memos that from World War II, whether it's Churchill or some of the other great figures of British history. But why don't we begin with his life, Barry? Tell us a little bit about his early life. He has an amazing name, which I was looking at today. I mean, it's an amazing name, and I'm going to try to pronounce it. Can you pronounce his whole name?
I can try. It's Erwin Johannes Eugen Rommel.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that's what I was having a hard time getting all my letters together to come out of my mouth. And
well, that's why we just call
tell
him
me
Rommel.
A little bit about his early life. Yeah, tell me a little bit about his early life, as much as we know.
Well, he's an interesting character, Rommel. Let me first start by saying Rommel was probably the most respected German commander of the war. Actually, there's no probably about it. On the Allied side, he was the most respected. His life is interesting in that he started off as a kind of a sickly child. His sister said he was a kind of a passive, calm-tempered boy. He developed a love of sports later as he grew older, particularly skiing. He was not a great student, though he had an aptitude towards engineering. In fact, he wanted to be an engineer. But his parents, particularly his father, convinced him to go in the military, and he did this before World War I, and far beyond just doing his basic duty as service in the Kaiser's army, he went on to make a military career of it. And World War I comes along, he's a commander of a company of Alpine troops, which is to say mountain troops, like our 10th Mountain Division. These are guys specially trained for mountain operations. And in that capacity, he was deployed when the war broke out. His unit was deployed to the Italian theater, where the Alps in the northern part of Italy, these giant mountains, where, of course, he had probably done some skiing before the war, and he knew the terrain fairly well. That became his area of operations. And, in fact, in 1917, at the Battle of Corporetto, which was the biggest battle of the war between the Italians and the Austrians and Germans, the Austrians and Germans were allies. His company did remarkable things. He outflanked the Italian position, and in a series of daring behind-the-enemy lines raids, very reminiscent of a special operations unit, Rommel and about 150 men of his company managed to capture 10 times as many Italians. And in fact, at one point, he captured as many as 15,000 Italians, which is one about 100-1, eventually earning him what was known as the Pour le Mérite, or the Blue Max. It was the highest award for valor that Germany, under the Kaiser, awarded, essentially their version of our Medal of Honor. So, you know, he ends the war, World War One, as a captain and highly decorated. And but Germany, of course, after the end of World War One, we've talked about this before, Silvio. At the end of World War One, Germany collapsed into chaos. The Kaiser abdicated, and communist revolutions broke out all throughout Germany. These little German Soviet republics, in the model of what had happened in Russia, and was ongoing in Russia, because about this time the Russian Civil War was just about to break out between the communists and the whites. And this was going on in Germany. There was a lot of fear that Germany would go the same way as Russia and become a Soviet communist state. And Rommel's unit was deployed in the streets to actually fight the communists. And he did that for 1919 and 1920 until finally these insurrections were put down. So after that, he spends the rest of his career of the 1920s and 30s in various capacities, including being a very popular officer, teaching infantry tactics, the stuff he had done in World War One, and even writes a book called Infantry and the Attack, which is widely read by both German officers and officers on the other side, Allied officers, or what would become, of course, Allied officers when the war breaks out. So the war does break out, but before it does break out, Rommel has come to the attention of Adolf Hitler, and I want to stop right here and dispel a myth about Rommel. Rommel was always painted as the good soldier, you know, in a sea of bad Nazi officers, and this, I'm just talking about stereotypes here, not that all Germans were Nazis, but, you know, the one officer the British and the Americans admired was Rommel, and a myth grew up about him and around him. That portrayed him as apolitical and anti-Nazi, and even that he despised everything that Hitler stood for. Well, that is only partially true, and it's only really true at the end of his life. From the 1930s on, where he came to the attention of Adolf Hitler, Rommel was Hitler's fair-haired boy. He was promoted very rapidly by Hitler, who saw his qualities and liked him. And his first big break was he was given command of Hitler's personal escort battalion, and then later escort brigade, which is a very prestigious position. So when the war breaks out in 1939, he's actually escorting the Führer's headquarters into Poland, Prussia, and guarding the Führer. And he had an opportunity being in the war room of Germany's high command to see just how effective the Panzer divisions were. Now, up until this point, he had had no experience with tank warfare. He was an infantry officer. But the kind of daring raids behind enemy lines that he was doing in World War One, he saw could be even done better with panzer formations, with tank formations, just because the mobility that mechanized warfare afforded. So he requested transfer to and command of one of the panzer divisions. By this point, he'd been promoted to general, in fact, two-star general, a major general. And in 1940, he was given command of the 7th Panzer Division. There were only 10 of these in the entire German army, so this was an extremely prestigious position. And he was put under the command of Heinz Guderian. Guderian is the main tank commander of the entire German army, kind of the father of panzer warfare. And in the invasion of France, which we've already talked about in a previous installment, Germany overruns France very rapidly in 1940, between May and June, in about a six-week lightning campaign, the Blitzkrieg it's called. And the main spearhead that led this was Guderian's Panzer Corps, of which Rommel's 7th Panzer was a big part. And right from the beginning, these guys were just meant for each other. Rommel and Guderian were soulmates. They both had a high disregard for higher authority. Rommel was known to turn off his radio so he wouldn't have to get orders from the rear while he was advancing. Time and again, both Guderian and Rommel were told by higher command to slow down. They were attacking too rapidly. And in fact, they were overrunning France so rapidly that the troops in the rear, the infantry, couldn't keep up with the tanks. The panzer divisions, their infantry were carried in trucks, so the infantry of the panzer division could keep up with the tanks, but the infantry divisions, who were still using horses, by the way, to draw their artillery, you know, to drag their artillery around. And most of their supply wagons were drawn by horses. They just couldn't keep up. And so Hitler and his chief of staff, various chiefs of staff, kept trying to tell Rommel and of course, his boss, Guderian, to slow the hell down. and these guys just kept driving. And eventually, Rommel got the reputation as, you know, it was called the Ghost Division because they kept disappearing from operational maps and reappearing where they were least expected, like a ghost. And, of course, they're just giving the Allies fits. And what, an interesting thing happened during this Battle of France in Normandy. The Germans under Rommel, the 7th Division, had penetrated into Normandy. In fact, he was coming from the opposite direction that Patton would come from when he overran Normandy 4 years later. Patton would be coming, of course, from the west, and Rommel was coming from the east. And during that campaign, Rommel was attacked. His formations were attacked by British tanks that were way too heavy for the standard anti-tank gun, which was a 37-millimeter anti-tank gun. And his German, these British heavy tanks, the Matildas, were just too heavily armored. And so the anti-tank shells just bounced off. And the German tanks themselves, the Mark IIs and Mark III Panzers, mostly had either very light guns or just a machine gun, so they couldn't stop a British tank. So Rommel did something very interesting that would change the course of the war because the Germans started mimicking what he did. And what he did was he brought up his anti-aircraft battalion, which they call flak battalion. And these things had these very long guns called 88s, 88-millimeter guns. And they're meant to knock down airplanes at high altitude. So they have extreme velocity and they're very long range. And what Rommel did is told them to just lower the gun down to horizontal, so it's on, you know, ground level, and shoot the tanks with it. And this thing can knock out any tank in the world at long range. Just blow the hell out of the British. And from then on, the Germans had a weapon they could defeat the heaviest of tanks with, and that was the 88. By the way, the same gun they would eventually put on their Tiger tanks 2 years later.
Let me get a couple of quick questions in. Yeah, go ahead and finish that, because I had a couple of quick questions, but maybe go ahead and finish the point you were going to make.
Well, this is a good point to stop, because I was going to say at this point, the Battle of France ends with German victory, and Rommel will next be transferred to Africa, where he will make his reputation as the Desert Fox. So it's a good time to take a pause.
Okay, I just wanted to get a couple of quick questions in. We'll take a break, and then we'll come back for the next segment. But when you mentioned that he wrote a book about infantry, and I'm fascinated by – I've never read a book about infantry, and I'm fascinated. That book that he wrote, what are those books like? I mean, are they like about strategy? And why would a book like that be very valuable, let's say, to someone today? Or are, in fact, those books valuable? That's the first thing I wanted to ask you. And go ahead and answer that. The next question is really easy. The next one is, was he involved at all in the Spanish Civil War? You remember we talked about how that's where the Germans tried out a lot of their equipment.
Yes. Okay. The answer to the first question is those kind of manuals like his are not interested in strategy, which is what generals concentrate on, which is the movement of large formations over a large area of terrain with the ultimate goal of conquering or defeating an enemy. That's strategy. But what a small unit commander, Rommel was a lieutenant in World War I and then a captain when he gained all his fame, he was interested in small unit tactics, company size, maybe battalion size, no more than 400 men. So we're talking about the maneuver of small units around and attacking various kinds of targets, enemies in dug-in positions, enemies in the open, using terrain to your advantage, using surprise and sudden attack. Rommel's hallmark was appearing where he was least expected. And in that way, he was George Patton, who had come around a little bit later in the war, and in fact, who had read Rommel's book, was Rommel's best student. And in fact, Rommel paid Patton a compliment by saying that tank warfare was never at its highest, never developed to its fullest until Patton came along. But Patton was a student of Rommel's.
Interesting.
And the second question.
And then the next question
was
about the Spanish Civil War.
Yeah, no, he didn't. During the 1930s, when the Germans were advising Franco's fascisti in winning that war against the communist-inspired Republicans, Rommel was in Germany teaching infantry tactics and then later leading the Führer's escort brigade. So no, he didn't take part in Spain.
One quick question about tank strategy before we take a break. You know, during the Gulf War, That was the big tank conflict that we had there with the Iraqi soldiers or the Iraqi tanks. Remember when we finally unleashed the ground war? And I'm just wondering if some of those tactics would still be used, let's say, in a war like that, because you know, it's like, for example, a book about baseball or hitting a baseball. If you read a book by Ted Williams from the 1940s, it's still very valuable today, even though, you know, the game is a little different, but you know, the essentials of hitting a baseball are the same. And I'm just wondering if a book like that would be read at the War College today, Barry.
Okay. That's a great question. And the answer is Rommel's book is out of date now, of course, because so many things would change the way we conduct infantry combat. And not just weapons, but things like helicopters give you air mobility and the kind of vehicles we have today are just so much different than in his day. But what is still studied, and in fact, Norman Schwarzkopf, who led our forces in Desert Storm so successfully, was a great admirer of Rommel's. He's quoted as saying, Rommel had a feel for the battlefield like no other man. And when you look at what Schwarzkopf did, which was basically outflank the right flank of Saddam Hussein's forces in Kuwait and going through the desert to do it, that is a mimicry of what we're going to talk about in the next segment, which is the kind of thing that Rommel did at the Desert Box against the British.
You know, the listeners are going to think that we set up these questions, but sometimes I get lucky. And I just ask you. Sometimes I get really lucky and I ask you a question that says, hey, this is what we're going to talk about next. Well, let's hold to that, and we'll talk about that next. We're going to take a little break. We'll hear from one of our sponsors, and we'll be back with Barry and lots of good stories left.
This is Carlos Quevez, Heartbeat, and I would like to see you guys this Saturday night at Nola Brasserie Authentic Cajun and Creole Restaurant, located at 1201 Main Street, downtown Dallas. I'll be performing instrumental high-energy jazz at 7:30 until midnight. So make your reservation today at 469-872-1820.
Well, I got to put in a good word here for my friend Carlos. In fact, Barry, if you were in Dallas tomorrow night, I would take you down to see Carlos because he's playing at Nola, which is a great restaurant. The music is great. It's kind of like a Latin jazz. We were there a few weeks ago, and it's just fantastic. So hopefully the next time you come to Dallas or if you're passing through here, Carlos is playing at Nola, and we'll take you down because it's just a fantastic performance. Well, let's get back to the Desert Fox there.
Before I get to Desert Fox, let me just say that my favorite steakhouse, and I will say one of the best in the country, is in Dallas, Texas. Actually, it's in Plano, which, is, as you know, is just north of Dallas. And it's called the Three Forks. Have you ever been there?
I don't think I've been to that one. There's so many here, of course. That is one of the top ones. And now that you have reminded me of it, I'm going to have to get out there sometime. And Plano is actually only about 5 miles north of where we live, so it wouldn't be that difficult to get there. Plano, of course, for those who enjoy trivia, is where the show Dallas actually took place. They were South Fork, I think, was the name of the ranch. And you can go by the ranch and see the South Fork ranch there in Plano, Texas, Barry.
I will have to make it a point to take a business trip sometime in the next year to come to Dallas just so I can meet with you and see your friend Carlos and eat some good steak.
Absolutely.
Nobody does it better than Texas.
I did, but I will disappoint you in one sense. Victoria Principal no longer lives in South Fork. She is she's not there anymore. So that's right. If you're madly in love with Victoria, like every guy was back in the late 70s, well, no, she doesn't look like that anymore. But that's and nobody does actually. So
yeah,
let's go back
like
to the desert. No, nobody does. My hair was a lot darker, to say the least. But But
all right, so
let's talk
getting
about,
back to our
yeah. Let's get back to the desert fox.
All right, so in we have to shift our attention away from Europe and down to North Africa. In June of 1940, when France was teetering on the brink of collapse, and the Germans were overrunning the north, Mussolini took an opportunity to stab France in the back. While their attention was fixed in the north against the Germans, the Italians invaded the French Riviera, declaring war on both England and France. They waited until 10th of June 1940, which was, over a year and a half since the war started. So Mussolini picked his time perfectly and stuck France in the back. Now, at that time, Mussolini had his own empire in some respects. He had tried to recreate the Roman Empire in the Mediterranean. He invaded Greece and come to grief, in fact, trying to invade Greece. He also controlled Libya and in Ethiopia, which he'd conquered in the 1930s. So there were Italian armies in both Libya and in Ethiopia. And now Mussolini set his sights on overrunning British-controlled Egypt, which, of course, has the Suez Canal, a vital waterway which allows the British Empire and the British fleets to transfer themselves from the Mediterranean into the Indian Ocean via the Red Sea. And of course, India is the crown and the jewel of the British Empire, and it's the ultimate goal of the Axis, particularly the Japanese, to capture India. So the British are kind of in an interesting position. They've got troops in Egypt that have to look in both directions. They got to look to the west, where in Libya, Mussolini has a large army of about 200,000, 250,000 men. And in their back, so to speak, looking towards Iraq, to the east, they've got to worry about attacking from that direction as insurrections break out in Iraq. When the Germans, we'll get to this in just a second, when the Germans overrun Greece, and that hasn't happened yet, but it'll happen later in 1940, Iraq will break into revolt against the British, and pro-Axis, pro-German groups, which will later become, by the way, the Ba'ath Party, the party of Saddam Hussein, will break up in revolt and force the British to send troops there. Also, the Japanese pushing through Burma into the gates of India will force the British to take troops out of Egypt. But let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. So on 10 June, again, Italy declares war. And in response, on the 14th of June, the British cross the wire, as they call it, the border between Libya and Egypt, which is all desert. This whole area of North Africa is nothing but desert and mountains in some areas, mostly desert and broken terrain. Very reminiscent of the Mojave Desert of California. The British cross the wire and they capture a border fort, Fort Capuzzo, and the Italians draw plans to attack into Egypt in response. And this comes on 13th of September when the Italians attack Egypt with 250,000 men. The British only have about 35,000 men, so the British are badly outnumbered. But the British have two things the Italians don't have. They have an excellent general by the name of Wavell, and they have a fighting spirit, which unfortunately the Italians just don't have. The Italians only make it about 60 miles into Egypt before their advance breaks down, and allow the British time to prepare for a counteroffensive, which Wavell launches in December. It's called Operation Compass. In Operation Compass, the British sweep into Libya, particularly in the area known as Cyrenaica, which is the part of Libya that is around the border of Egypt, where Benghazi is. If you remember the recent events in Benghazi, that's where that's located. And the British, in 1 month, completely reverse the Italian gains, and Wavell rolls up the Italian army like a house of cards. And the entire 10th Italian army is crushed. It either is destroyed or surrenders. By the 16th of December, the British have taken almost everything. And early into January, they capture, at the Battle of Dita Fram, General O'Connor, the British leader of the 7th Armored Division, captures and forces the surrender of the Italian army in Libya. So Hitler, to bolster his ally, decides to send Rommel there with a very small force. Rommel's only given a tiny force of, well, eventually be three divisions, a corps, but it only starts off as a reconnaissance unit, no more than 1,000 guys total. And he's told to basically go bolster the Italians, take command of their armored formations that are in Tripoli, which is much further east, and hold on, make sure they don't collapse. But something happens during this period of the month between Rommel getting there and the British overrunning the Italians. Hitler invades Greece, and that's where his main effort is, by the way. And to stop the advance of Hitler's legions in Greece, Churchill decides to pull most of Wavell's forces out of North Africa and send them to what will turn out to be a doomed attempt to save Greece. So Rommel, arriving on the scene, takes a reconnaissance flight over the British positions in Karanika, right along the border. His forces are positioned in a place called Alagila, which is right at the base of the Karanikan Bulge. If your listeners would go to a map and look at a map of Libya, they'll see there's a bulge there called the Karanikan Bulge, and that's where most of this we're going to talk about today takes place. It's in that area. And in flying over this area with his little observation plane called a Storch, he sees the British are really pretty thin on the ground. There's not a whole lot of them there. They most of them pulled out. So he disobeys orders, which is kind of typical of Rommel. Instead of holding ground and just staying where he is and to make sure the Italians don't collapse, he takes the scanty forces he has, no more than a regiment all total, and whatever Italians will join him, and he attacks. And he's wildly successful. In weeks, he overruns the entire Karanikan Bulge, rolling up the British and capturing General O'Connor himself in the process. The only part of the Karanikan Bulge that isn't captured is Tobruk, which is a vital port, unfortunately, for Rommel, because that's where all the supplies have to come in. Otherwise, they have to be shipped clear from Tripoli, which is far into the country, some 600 miles away. But the Australian division takes Tobruk and fortifies and holds it. And this will be a thorn in Rommel's side for the next 2 years. But other than that, he overruns almost the entire position, British position, in the Karanikan Bulge. Until finally, on the wire, it's called the dash to the wire, he makes it all the way to the border of Egypt, he runs out of gas. His troops don't have any gas because they're not getting enough supplies. And he's forced to halt and give the British time to build up their forces. The British have a much better supply situation because they have the Suez Canal and complete naval dominance, whereas the Italians and the Germans have to trickle supplies across between Italy and North Africa, hoping the British Navy doesn't interdict them. And they do. The British sink a lot of his supply throughout this next 2 years. But he succeeds in overrunning Karanika and throwing the British back into Egypt. And that's in 1941. And during that period, from 10 of April 1941 until many months later, they lay siege to Tobruk, where the British forces, elements of the 7th Armored Division and the Australians, will hold out brilliantly, and they'll call themselves the Desert Rats. They're called the Desert Rats because it was a battle of rats. It was a battle in the rubble of Tobruk, which the British had fortified and was under a constant artillery attack by the Germans. And the Italians, mostly the Italians, would make attacks on Tobruk trying to penetrate the city. And the British and the Australians would throw them back out. And interesting enough, the Australians were terrified of the Italians were terrified of the Australians for whatever reason. I'm not sure why. The Aussies were considered to be wild men, and they scared the hell out of the Italians. And there's one very amusing incident that took place during this time when Rommel was inspecting the Tobruk front in his German staff car. And most of his forces, by the way, let me just clarify something. He had the Deutsche Afrika Korps, which was three German divisions, the 21st Panzer, the 15th Panzer, and the 90th Light Division. And that was his main striking force. And never had more than about 200 tanks at his best, and often way less, far less, depending on the supply situation. But these were Germans. They knew how to fight wars, and their panzer divisions were better than anyone else's divisions. It was a real combined arms package of infantry, artillery, and tanks, well-coordinated, which no one else at the time was doing. But the Italians were second rate at best. And though their armored formations were a little bit better, their equipment was out of date. It was antiquated. Their tanks were terrible. Their planes not much better. And the Italian soldiers had terrible leadership. Italian officers had nothing to do with their men. They treated their men with disdain. Often they're aristocrats commanding armies of what were peasants or shopkeepers. And an Italian officer thought nothing of being absent from the front during a battle. You know, he would stay in his headquarters and send orders by radio, but never go near the front. And this was completely different than the German approach. Rommel, to a fault, was always in the front. In fact, he often led his advances in the first tank. He'd be in the very first tank leading the advance, as was every one of his division commanders and all his regimental commanders. They always led from the front. And if he was at his headquarters and there was a battle going on somewhere there in the vicinity, he would get in his plane, his Storch, and he'd fly to the battlefield, land, and join the battle. And it gave him an amazing ability to coordinate the attacks up front and personal with no lag time. He could see immediately what needed to be done, and being the supreme commander, he could call in reinforcements as needed and exploit whatever success they were having, which made him amazingly successful, and not to mention inspiring to his troops.
I was going to say that has to make him, you know, that has to make him popular with the troops, you know, the big guys out there. Rather than sitting in some room, you know, looking at charts, he's actually out there in front. I can see why they like him.
Well, in fact, he was very much like Patton. Patton and Rommel are so much alike. Both of them, and MacArthur for that matter, both of them liked the camera. And if you ever see pictures of Rommel, he is a handsome man. He's always dressed in a long leather coat or in khaki, and he's with his goggles perched on his hat perfectly. And he loved to get pictures taken of him, and it was good for morale, and it was good for the home front. He became, of course, a hero because of this. Often he was known to, if the picture didn't turn out right, he'd get it taken a second time. If the film crew didn't get the right angle and the lighting was wrong, he'd have them redo it. And Patton was the same way, and MacArthur was too. Because morale plays a big part. And in this age of video, age of film, that was a new tool the commanders had at their disposal to project their image to the public. So getting back to this anecdote, so during the siege of Tobruk, the Australians sally out in an attack outside of the wire. They're attacking into the besieging lines where the Italians are positioned. And again, the Italians were terrified of the Australians. And Rommel just happens to be inspecting the Italians' units of that sector when this attack comes, this counterattack comes from within the fortress. And the Italians are so terrified of the oncoming Australians who are charging them with bayonets that they panic and freeze, not even shooting their weapons. And the Italian commander on the scene turns to Rommel and says, "What should we do?" And Rommel just very dryly said, "You can stop it by firing your weapons." He got back in his car and left. "You can stop it by firing your weapons."
That's well. He's got a sense of humor on top of everything else, right? I like that. I like that about Rommel. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
So I'm gonna do my best Winston Churchill imitation here. But during this time in 1942, Churchill on the House of Commons says something which he is very uncharacteristic. He actually compliments the enemy. Of course, Churchill was a great and huge hater of the Nazis. But of Rommel, he said, here we go, "We have a very daring and skillful opponent against us, and may I say, across the havoc of war, a very great general." How was that?
I think you ought to be on the History Channel playing Churchill. That's what I think. We just got to get you a big cigar and put on maybe like 50 pounds on you. And
we have
a big cigar.
We share that love of cigars and brandy, me and being that one.
Yes. We just got to get you a girl named Clementine. And we
there
get
you
a
my darling
cigar. That's it. His beautiful Clementine,
So continuing, so in 1941 ends with Rommel being thrown back to the starting point where he began the beginning of the year at Alagila. by a British counterattack. Rommel just doesn't have the supplies to maintain the offensive, and the British eventually push him back under their new commander, a guy named Claude Auchinleck, in what was called Operation Crusader in November of 1941. So 1942 comes along, and Rommel has he's out of Cyrenaica, and he's back in the Tripolitania area of Libya, and he builds up his supplies. And he makes another attack. And in January of 1942 begins very much like February and March of 1941 did, with Rommel bursting out of Alagila and again overrunning Cyrenaica. And this time the British stop him just west of Tobruk at what's called the Gazala Line. Now, I want you to think about it this way. The desert is not soft sand. There is going to be soft sand we're going to talk about shortly when we get to the Battle of El Alamein. It's mostly, though, desert like we have in California. It's rocky. It's hard-baked dirt. And unlike the usual myth of the desert warfare where tanks can just sail across the desert like ships at sea, units basically have to stick to supply lines. And they create these depots of supplies, mostly fuel and ammunition, which the British call boxes. And these boxes are concrete pillboxes in a network surrounded by wire and anti-tank obstacles. And the British would position whole units, brigades and battalions inside these, and sometimes divisions inside these boxes, which were fairly extensive fortifications. And because of the size of the desert, these might be across an area of several hundred miles, all interlocked with each other, each one separated by minefields. And these minefields are called mine marshes. So the British line extended from north to south, with the anchor point in the north being the fortress of Tobruk, which they still hold, and then going southward down into the desert for hundreds of miles down to a place called Gazala, and actually a box called the Berhakian, don't got that Arab in there, but Berhakian box, which is defended by the Free French. And Rommel launches an offensive after several months of both sides kind of glaring at each other over this line, the Gazala line, Rommel on the west side and the British on the east side. Rommel, in May of 1942, launches an assault. It's called the Battle of Gazala, in which he pins down the British line with his Italian forces. And by the way, this is kind of clever. What he did is he took aircraft engines off of the planes and mounted them on trucks. And then behind his Italian formations, he'd have these propellers blowing sand and dirt up into the air and creating a lot of noise and making the British behind their boxes, behind the wire, see this massive sandstorm and hear all this noise and see the Italians coming. And they thought it was the whole darn German army. It was the whole darn Africa Corps and the Italians, make him seem like a lot more troops attacking than there were. Instead, the mass of his troops, his entire mobile force, the Africa Corps plus all the Italian armored forces, he launched them far, far south, actually south into the desert, beyond where Berhakian, the very end of the British line, was located. And in a sweep around, heading east and around their flank, driving in a big hook motion from east to north, he outflanks the British line and drives deep into the rear area, captures many of their headquarters. The British counterattack, and what follows is called the Cauldron Battle, in which Rommel's forces, with their back now up against the very minefields the British had used to defend their Gazala line to the east, to the west, forms a circular perimeter of his entire Africa Corps and fights off every attack the British launch at him, using his 88-millimeter guns to kill their tanks and then counterattack them with his own. And this battle of the Cauldron breaks the British 8th Army, breaks their teeth on it, trying to defeat him. And from there, he bursts out of the position, out of the Cauldron position. He's behind enemy lines, of course, at this point, and he drives north towards the coast. And on June 13th, what occurs is called Black Sunday, in which he crushes the British armored divisions. And actually, a couple days later, succeeds in overrunning Tobruk as well. The fortress of Tobruk finally falls on 21st of June. It was a very dark day for the Allies, Silvio. They're losing in the Pacific to the Japanese, and now Rommel has defeated them in Africa, and things look very, very bleak indeed for the British.
This is the summer of 42 that we're talking about, right?
Summer
the summer
of 42,
right? Yeah.
It's actually about 3 weeks after the Battle of Midway, interesting enough.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, at this point, the Midway had no direct effect on the fact that Japanese were overrunning Burma and Singapore was in fall. So it's a black day for the British, and Rommel uses his advantage, and with Hitler's blessing, even though his supply lines are overextended already, and his tank forces are depleted, he launches an all-out assault for Egypt with the idea of taking Cairo. Now let's just stop for a second and think about what could have happened had Rommel had the supplies needed. You know, had he been given more forces? He only had three divisions. If Hitler sent to Rommel, say, three more divisions, you know, six instead of three, twice what he did. And this is something that the Germans were certainly capable of doing because they did it half a year later when it was too late, when Tunisia was under attack. They heavily reinforced up to 250,000 German troops. But by that point, the opportunities were gone. But in summer of 42, Rommel is advancing into Egypt with only 70 tanks left of the entire Africa Corps. But he's got the momentum on his side, and Hitler says, let him go. You know, let him take advantage of success. And he drives deep, deep into Egypt and eventually to a place called El Alamein. And El Alamein is a choke point, a natural choke point, and it's really the last one before Cairo and Alexandria and the Suez Canal beyond that. To the north is the Mediterranean Sea, and that's where the town of El Alamein is. And to the south, only 40 miles south, you can't go any further south because there's a thing called the Qatara Depression. And this is a sea of sand. It's nothing but very loose sand dunes, which mechanized forces can't traverse. Trucks would break down. Tanks would sink up to their axles. And infantry would get lost. So that's a natural anchor point. So the British stop them at El Alamein. And the first battle of El Alamein between Rommel and British 8th Army, which at this point, by the way, has been changed command once again. The British actually changed commands four times during these last 2 years. And this last commander was a guy named General William Gott, who was given command by Churchill and by Harold Alexander as Rommel's advancing into Egypt. And unfortunately for him, but probably fortunate for the British, his plane crashes and he's killed. And he's replaced by his adjutant, a guy named Bernard Montgomery. And we're going to hear a lot about Montgomery, or Monty as he's called, in the moments to come.
But that's right. Montgomery, that's one of the other big names.
Commander. He is indeed. He's the British biggest name in the British World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So the first battle of El Alamein begins with Rommel trying to break through with a scant force of 70 tanks, and he's by this point almost out of gasoline. And the battle goes on from July 1st, 1942, to July 27th, and it ends with Rommel stopped. And the second battle of El Alamein, which Montgomery counterattacks and drives Rommel out of Africa, takes place on October 23rd through 11th of November, and it ends with Rommel being driven completely out of Africa by vastly superior British forces. And if you don't mind, I'm going to do my second impersonation of Winston Churchill, because at this point, this is the first victory, very first victory the British have really enjoyed to date.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the first decisive victory that didn't end in disaster as Wobbles did. So on the House of Commons, Churchill made a speech, and it became very famous. He said, "I have never promised anything but blood, tears, toil, and sweat. Now, however, we have a new experience. We have victory, a remarkable and definite victory. Rommel's army has been defeated. It has been routed. It has been very largely destroyed as a fighting force. Now, this is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end, but it is, perhaps, the end of the beginning."
Oh, I love the way he talked. And you do such a wonderful job. But I love the way he used what you just did, the way he would use words, the way he just did in that speech. What a an absolutely amazing story. Well, we got a couple of minutes, and I know there's probably a lot more to go, but I wanted to get, if we could, just get a little bit, maybe take a minute or so and talk about his... let's talk about the end of Rommel, and just give me a quick... quick story about how he ended. I mean, here's a man who was on top of the world, and at one point in the summer of 42, and by 44, he fell in disgrace, Barry.
Yes. In future installments, we will get to other chapters of Rommel's career, so we don't need to talk about him tonight. But let me just round up by telling what happened to him. Rommel grew increasingly disenchanted with Hitler, particularly as the Allies invaded in Normandy, where Rommel was in command by that point in 1944. And Rommel was drawn into the plot. We don't know how deep, but he was drawn into the plot to kill Hitler. The idea of the Operation Valkyrie was certain conspirators in the German army, most of them higher-ranking officers, were going to assassinate Hitler. Everybody remembers the movie with Tom Cruise, the called Valkyrie. They planted a bomb underneath Hitler's table at his headquarters. But the plot failed because the bomb was put on the wrong side of a heavy table leg, and that heavy table leg shielded Hitler from the blast. But the plot was to kill Hitler, and Rommel was to be put in command of Germany. He was going to be made president of Germany because he was the only commander the Allies respected enough to negotiate with. And the idea was at this point the Germans would negotiate a peace on the Western Front with the Allies and then be able to be free to fight Stalin in the East. And that was the plan. It failed because, Hitler wasn't killed by the bomb blast. And in the subsequent purges in which Hitler rounded up all the conspirators, it was found out that his fair-haired boy, Rommel, had turned against him. So Hitler had Rommel visited by two members of the Gestapo, and they told Rommel, you have two choices. You can either take your own life quietly, and we will let the country think that you died of your wounds, because he had been wounded just before that and was, in fact, still convalescing. We'll put it out that you died of your wounds, and you'll get a state funeral, and you'll be a national hero, and your wife and your son and your daughter will be fine. We won't arrest them as well. Or you can demand a trial, in which case you'll probably be killed anyway, and we will then disgrace your name, and your wife and son will be arrested as well. So Rommel, of course, took the former, not the latter, and he took his own life, mm-hmm. and it was put out. Everybody thought he had died of his wounds until the war ended, and then it was found out that he was part of that plot, et cetera. May I play something for you?
Yeah,
this is
go ahead.
Winston Churchill actually talking about the death of Rommel. You ready?
Yes, let's go.
His life and fate have best been summed up, ironically enough, in the words of Nazi Germany's fearless enemy, the Honorable Winston Churchill. His ardor and daring inflicted grievous disasters upon us, but he deserves the salute for which I made him. In the House of Commons in January 1942. He also deserves our respect because, although a loyal German soldier, he came to hate Hitler and all his works and took part in the conspiracy to rescue Germany by displacing the maniac and tyrant. For this, he paid the forfeit of his life. In the song of wars of our democracy, there is little place for chivalry.
And there you have it.
And that was Churchill on the radio, I assume, talking to the British people?
Yes, and it was after the war had ended. We found out what actually happened to Rommel.
Yeah. Well, this is not going to be the last time that we talk about Rommel, because he was obviously a personality for a couple more years after the North Africa. But without question, I think just this is one of the most interesting personalities of World War II, and somebody that we'll come back to a little bit later when we have a little bit more time. I just wanted to take a quick minute. We really only have about a minute each to talk about what just happened in Los Angeles, where a presidential candidate from Mexico came and criticized President Trump on American soil. And I just find that to be despicable. And I wish that, I mean, he's entitled to criticize Trump in Mexico, obviously. That's fine. That's within the political boundaries. But I'm surprised that the governor of California did not stop him and say, no, don't do that. Don't come here and criticize the president of the United States. I guess I'm disappointed more with the governor than I am with the presidential candidate, Barry.
Well, a couple things. First, you can be disappointed, but you shouldn't be surprised that Governor Moonbeam, a leftist governor, a leftist Democrat, who is, like all Democrats in California, deeply in bed with La Raza and other Chicano activist groups, Hispanic, they don't call them Chicanos anymore, Hispanic. You know, the Democrats rely on the Hispanic vote in California. And so what this guy is doing is he's coming to America and he's drumming up support or fervor against Trump's border plans. Now, that's the first thing. The second thing, which I find disturbing and irritating, is the utter hypocrisy of Mexican officials and Mexican politicians who cloak themselves in this cloak of sanctity and righteousness when they rail against our border policy and the fact we stop the free flow of migrants and walls that divide people and on ad nauseum. But if you look at Mexico, their southern border is heavily defended. It is a felony to cross the border in which you get thrown into prison. You're not just deported, you're in prison for years if you cross their border. And on top of which, it is against their constitution, as you point out in your article in the American Thinker. It's article, 33 of the Mexican Constitution makes it illegal for us to do what that guy is doing in California. You could not go to Mexico and say anything against them.
That's right. And that's an article. There's a long history behind that article, which we really don't have time. It kind of goes back to the 19th century when Mexico was interfered by a lot of European powers, the French and so on. And I think they were actually afraid of people from the outside coming in. So there's a history to the article, but the hypocrisy is obvious, as you indicated. And as I mentioned in my article, I was really disappointed with the governor of California, because I'll tell you a quick story. When Hugo Chavez went to the United Nations and spoke very poorly of President Bush back in 2007, there was a Democrat, Charlie Rangel. We have a lot of differences with him. But yet Charlie Rangel did stand up and say, don't come into my district and speak that way about the president of the United States. So that was an honest Democrat who was willing to put the country before his party. I think Jerry Brown, unfortunately, doesn't do that, and I'm disappointed, but as you say, probably shouldn't be surprised. Well, quickly, tell me where we go next. We've got about 30 seconds, so tell me where we go next with World War II.
Well, with World War II, we're the next installment will begin with the most, you could say maybe it's the most striking, important, decisive element of World War II, conflict of World War II, and that was Operation Barbarossa and the German invasion of Russia. This was June of 1941.
Ooh, I love that name, by the way, Barbarossa. And yes, I'm looking forward to that. And very quickly, there's a great movie, a great book. Well, the movie I've seen, the book I have not read, about Rommel. Just give me a grade for the book, if you've read it, or the movie.
You know, the book is called The Desert Fox by Desmond Young. It was written just after the war. It's very good. It's a better read, for instance, than Rommel's biography itself, which is just about the desert campaign. I'd give it a 10-star rating. I'd give it at least 8 stars out of 10. Now, the movie stars James Mason. It's called also The Desert Fox, and it's a good movie. Those who knew Rommel said that Mr. James Mason was too nice, that Rommel was a much more acerbic, sharp-tongued figure who didn't suffer fools gladly. So that might be the one criticism, but it's still a very good movie.
I think it is. I think it's a good movie, worth watching to get a sense
yes.
of the man. Barry, have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next week.
I'm looking forward to it. Take care.
All right. Thank you so much. Well, that's it, our story of Rommel, with our good friend Barry Jacobson. Great story. I'm always fascinated by this man. We'll talk to you later. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.